I'm so sorry for the losses that have been expressed today, and wish you peace and comfort and the love of your family and friends. Well, it's Father's Day. Do we have any fathers here today? We have fathers in the blood sense, and I'm guessing we have fathers who've been mentors and kind people to other people in their own particular ways. And we are grateful for all of you who express your love to others. It feels to me like there are so many lost people in the world. When I think of home, I think of all those people. And I think of my time in Ghana, where I remember Kwame, one of my students, saying, oh, I have to go to another funeral this weekend. And for Kwame, that meant about a five-hour drive up to his home village. And I said, well, Kwame, do you have to go to them all? And he said, don't take our funerals away from us. And I was quite surprised at the enthusiasm of his response. But I realize funerals are a weak affair, generally speaking, in Ghana. And people come from the United States, from the UK, from wherever they've gone, sometimes a year later, because it takes that long for them to amass the money to come home. But they put the body away and save it, and they have this amazing funeral. I've been to a few, and they're quite amazing. They wash the body, they show the body, they parade the body to the church, there's a service, and then for about 5 or 6 days, celebrating. And that's the time where they tell their stories, the stories of their town, their village. It's the time when they catch up with each other. They know who they are, and they know where they belong. They know what home means in the Ghanaian culture. Something that we kind of struggle with because we have such a transient society. I've lived in 29 different homes in 3 different countries. And as far as traditions are concerned, we kind of pick and choose our traditions. Some of us have traditions that have been handed down through the family, but many of us sort of pick up what we want or not along the way. And we just don't have the sense of rootedness that, for example, a Ghanaian does. I'm going to focus on 2 situations today of people who are searching for home in one way or another. 2.5. Members of BUF have welcomed 2 Syrian families in the past year. The government provides some assistance for them, but our volunteers in our church have provided learning the buses, orientation to the community, medical and dental setup, how to budget and set up a bank account, how to deal with your kids in church, school, how to interact with the school, setting up the house, furniture, anything that they need. And now Bassam, who's the father of the first family, has finally passed his written and his driving test, and now they're looking for a van because of the size of their family. Hopefully a van will be donated, and if not, then a van at a very low price. So if anybody of you know any connections for a van, let me know. But they are, these Syrian families. The first one that came stayed with one of our members for 3 months until finally an apartment was found for them, and now a better apartment has been found for them. The brother of the first family's wife lived in the East Coast, and they landed in a place where there wasn't any support. They got the government assistance for, it's a subsistence for food and medical and housing, but nothing like what the other family was getting here. So she very tentatively said to Kara, our lead person, would it be possible that you could also host my brother and his family? And Kara took it on. And they lived with Kara again for 3 months while they found an apartment. And those two families have been united. One of them was in a refugee camp in Jordan for 10 years. All of the children were born there. And the other one was also in a refugee camp, and I don't remember how long or where that was. But they were separated there, and they were separated in the U.S., and now they've been united. And there actually is a pretty strong Syrian community in Bellingham, so they've been wonderful at helping them too. So they're finding home in a different way. Much of it has been community and family. I've mentioned to you Katya, my Ukrainian friend, who's a refugee, and I'm going to tell you more about where she's at this point. I texted her this week because when it gets to deep conversations, it's easier for her on text so she can use Google Translate. Although she's been working so hard on her English, and her English is vastly improved in the year that she's been studying. She tells me about when they were still in Mariupol and their apartment complex was bombed. So she sent a picture of her and her family in the basement of the apartment through the broken window. The whole window is cattywampus. And she said, my sister and I lay in that cold basement and held hands tightly and prayed a prayer from the Bible. I often remember the basement and the shelling. The fear is incomparable when you can die any second. So she experienced that for a while until she escaped, and I won't go through the pathway to get here. I met her when I answered a call to have some yard work done, and kind of fell in love with Katya, and we had a shower, which I've mentioned before. But she moved into an apartment after that. We had a shower that completely furnished the apartment with everything that they needed. But that she moved in with two women who I think are in their 30s or 40s. One woman in her 30s who had two small children, toddlers, and has had a new baby, and is in the process of probably divorcing her husband, who comes over and they fight all the time. The children scream and fight all the time. The mother never takes them out of the house. The mother goes out and in the garbage, she pulls things out of the garbage and puts them in bags and boxes and brings them into the house. And she showed me pictures and I said, oh, Katya, are you moving? No, this is what Lila has brought in. So she's in an untenable situation. And as soon as the Bellingham Festival of Music is over in mid-July, she's gonna come and live with me until she's able to find a place that is suitable for her. She says about her living space, it's very important for me to have my own home where I can relax and unwind at the end of the hard day. For me, home is a reboot. Losing my favorite place makes me feel lonely. And I miss my sisters and brothers so much. She had 9 siblings. I pray for my country and for all the people who are in trouble. Now many regions will be left without water. There will be little food. There is no more wheat in the fields, and I'm worried about what Ukrainians are going to eat this summer, this winter. A big problem for me, of course, is the language barrier. I love to discuss different topics and be filled with the wisdom of other people. When you are alone with yourself, you have to fight with your thoughts and feelings. Katya actually expressed thoughts of suicide to me a couple of months ago. She came over for dinner, and I said, how are you? And she said, fine. And I said, that doesn't sound like fine. And she began to cry and told me it was just so hard and she just didn't know if she wanted to keep on living. This is not uncommon for refugees. My sister-in-law, who taught ESL for many years, says that between 6 months and a year, they often hit a wall where they just feel terribly depressed and discouraged and anxious and, survival guilt and a lot of hard stuff. Oh dear. Okay, no. I think maybe my pages got mixed up. Let me just check. I haven't been able to figure out with this printer how to put numbers on pages, and I forgot to do it today. Well, maybe it's not. It's just because I extemporized and lost my place. Okay. So when I was in Toronto in the 60s, I taught ESL at a community college, and there the refugees and immigrants were given 6 months of a reasonable standard of living, I mean, enough to afford a house and food without starvation. And they learned English for 6 hours a day. And by the end of 6 months, they had a good command of the language, good enough to go out and get a decent paying job and start paying taxes. What a good program, right? And for some of them, there were other programs afterwards that they could engage in, like furniture making and different practical things that they could do. That program has gone by the wayside. Don't know why. But I think it's really important for us to be aware of who's in our midst and how can we be there for them. My God, we have it so easy in so many ways when you hear the stories of people like Katya and like the Syrian refugees. Okay, so today on Father's Day, I'm thinking about all the men in the prison industrial complex in this country. For example, Keith Lamar, who is on death row and scheduled to be executed on November 16th this year. Keith has written this book called Condemned. On the back is the, I guess they don't use a chair anymore, it's a bed where they electrify him. He had a choice of that or drugs, one or the other. Keith says, to say that the criminal justice system is racist and unjust is to state the obvious. A black man who takes the life of a white person is 13.5 times more likely to receive the death penalty than a white person who takes the life of a black person. And while black people only make up 12.6% of this nation's population, anyone want to guess how many, what percent are of people on death row are black? I hear whispers, I don't hear real numbers. 80? It's a little high. It's 41.83% of the total 3,100 inmates on death row are black. Way more than the percentage in the population, of course. U.S. has now more of its citizens in prison or under some form of government supervision than any other nation in the world. And to put this in perspective, the U.S. now has 9 times more people incarcerated per 1,000 than South Africa during apartheid, and close to twice the number of incarcerated than Stalin's Soviet Union. What kind of country have we become? That's really, really horrible. Some of these men who have are men who have children and have rarely seen their children and haven't been part of their upbringing. Some of them were put into prison when they were so young they weren't able to have children, and that's the case with Keith Lamar. He was 17. When he was involved in a drug deal, he was selling, somebody else was buying. The guy who was buying went berserk and pulled a gun. Keith pulled a gun, killed the other guy. He knew that he'd done something wrong and bad, and he, when he went to court, he said, I'm guilty. So there wasn't a trial. He was willing to accept what was appropriate for him at that time. The author of a book that inspired Keith changed his name to Bomani, and I forget exactly what it means. It's something like powerful warrior. The author of the book that inspired Bomani, Dennis O'Hearn, writes that Bomani's story details a compelling defense against the capital condemnation he has endured at the hands of the system that is not just broken, but actively made not to work. It's a system that is twisted by public officials who are corrupt, prejudiced, often vindictive, and sometimes just lazy. By scared men. Oh, there's the rest of Katya. Years ago, this would have just put me into a panic. I'm just going to let that pass. Scared men who are willing to sacrifice others so that they may survive those prejudices and corruptions, and by a scared public that has become convinced that we will be safer if we can just lock up more men and throw away the keys. In 1993, 4 years into Bomani's sentence, and at a point where he had really grown internally and become a wiser human being, the Muslims in the prison requested for the TB testing that was going to be done on Tuesday that they be able to spit into a cup, which is one way of TB testing, or have an x-ray. But the prison was insisting on injecting something into them, which was against their Muslim laws. It was accepted in other prisons to do it an alternate way, but this prison warden was very hardline and had been chosen for the fact that he was very hardline. And he basically blew them off and said, this is a frivolous claim and we're not going to do it. And I expect that you're all going to participate on Tuesday. There's a lot of thought that the riot that occurred on the weekend was actually something that they had been working towards because they wanted to build a supermax prison and they needed proof that things were really bad and they had terrible people. So, let's see, the warden refused to consider the request, but that really was just the spark that lit the fire. Bomani went into, he was out in the yard exercising, and actually he and a friend had run 15 miles in the yard that day because they were really into physical fitness, amongst other things. And suddenly there was a disturbance and a couple of guys came out with a body and threw it in the yard. The guards didn't do anything. This is 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The guards didn't do anything. A riot ensued. Many of the people in the prison were released by other prisoners. Bomani heard, he was out in the yard, choosing to stay out of it. He heard that they were looting the cells and stealing things, and he had some rather precious things like his keyboard, and he was a boxer, his boxing gloves, and books that were precious to him. So he went in, thinks he was in there a total of 10 minutes, just getting a few of his things out. It was 2 o'clock in the morning before finally the Ohio State Highway Patrol came out into the yard and with automatic weapons pointed at the heads of the inmates. They were forced into the gymnasium where they were stripped naked, hands tied or locked behind their backs, and made to sit on the floor for several hours. Then they were placed in random groups of 10 and pushed into cells that were designed to house one person. And it was there that the first murder occurred. This was blamed on Bomani in spite of the fact that A, he didn't know the man, had nothing against him. B, he never touched him. And C, he thinks the reason it was blamed on him because he told the other inmates not to cooperate with the authorities when they were questioning. So he got targeted for that killing. Somehow, through offers of deals for those who snitched, Bomani got fingered for organizing a death squad in this 10 minutes that he was in there and killing 9 men. Those who were encouraged to talk together and get their stories straight and thus sell their souls were given special treatment. They were put in a special wing. They were given freedom of movement within that wing. They were they had special meals brought in to them, including Thanksgiving dinner with the prosecutor who called them his family. Now tell me that there isn't something wrong with that scenario. Years later, this facility would be called Snitch Academy. The prosecutor in his case refused to cooperate and give exculpatory evidence. I had to look that one up. That means evidence would have shown that he was innocent. So all that the jury heard were the snitches' stories, and in many cases, the snitches were ones who had done the murdering. But it gave them a get-out-of-jail-free card. They got their sentences shortened, and at the time of this writing, they're all at home, and he's on death row. So his lawyer heard that they were going to give him a plea deal, and that that could run concurrently with the one that he had. And as they said, you could be out in your 50s. Omani's response to that is, why are y'all doing this? Y'all know I didn't kill those people. I wasn't even in there. And they told him if they confessed, he would serve the terms concurrently and be out of prison soon. Omani says, I couldn't say yes because I said no and went forward under the illusion that justice was real and that the truth would set me free. Was I being naive? Yes. And I went to trial because I believed in the system and the process of justice. Even after, and the, reading this book, I was just increasingly shocked and horrified at the treatment that he received, even up to that point, and especially after that point. However, I was on my way to finding out that the truth can only set you free when you have enough money to level the playing field. In reality, there exist two different systems, one for those who have money and a very different one for those who are poor. Same thing I'm finding with Marion and a home for her in her last years or months. In this case, the rigged system put the nails in his coffin. Without the evidence of the other inmates who could have proved that he was innocent, the jury and the judge had no option but to give him the death penalty. When Bomani returned to the prison, he found that all his belongings had been moved into the death house, 50 feet away from where executions took place. He felt devastated and alone. Emptied to the degree that it made him wish for death. But in the morning, he awoke to nature and the sun, and he recalled a poem written by Rabindranath Tagore. I forgot to practice that one before I came. Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain, but for the heart to conquer it. Let me not look for allies in life's battlefield, but for my own strength. Let me not crave an anxious fear to be saved, but hope for the patience to win my freedom. Grant me that I may not be a coward, feeling your mercy in my success alone, but let me find the grasp of your hand in my failure. That's the day after he was given the death penalty. Bomani was transferred to another much harsher prison along with six other inmates, and the treatment there was absolutely appalling, including a list of brainwashing techniques developed by a psychologist and used for the breaking of men's minds. It was presented at a conference. Further appeals seemed like they would correct the lies, but they apparently came up with the same corruption, racism, and old boyism. And his previous prosecutor continued to be the one that put forth the prosecution. And it was only after several of those appeals that finally a new lawyer for him, which of course was a lawyer appointed by the state, was able to get the evidence from the other people, the statements from the other people that would have saved him at his trial. Omani has taken this time of incarceration to educate himself, and more than that, to develop his spirituality. Each morning and several times a day, he meditates, and he says, "In my pain, I discovered that there was something indestructible inside of me. And more than that, this was something highly intelligent and able to assist me in my struggle to overcome what I was going through." Somehow he found his own voice in snippets of relationships with prisoners who showed him kindness and solidarity. And he connected with people who sent him wonderful books of wisdom that he took in and really got at a deep level. He says, "I don't regret this time in prison because it is here that I found myself. I have the courage of my convictions. I discovered that moral strength is far greater than physical strength, and that, as Martin Luther King suggested, the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." Unfortunately, because of his principles, he says, "I must be brutally honest, most of all to myself. I will not lie and will not incriminate another human being to save myself. And that's why I face execution in November of this year." Home for Bomani is being true to himself and seeking justice for himself and for others. It's being able to live with integrity and be reunited with his family. And I imagine if he were able to be freed instead of being executed in November, he would have a powerful influence on the prison system. At the end of the book, Bomani says, "Let me remind you, there was no evidence linking me to any of the crimes that occurred during the Lucasville uprising." He's not saying I wasn't guilty of murder of that young man years ago. He agrees to that. "The only evidence in the Lucasville case, if you can call it that, was presented in my case, came from the testimony of the actual perpetrators of those crimes, the snitches, and now they are out of prison for their lies. This is a fact. So again, if the state is successful in their efforts to murder me on November 16th this year, it won't be because I'm actually guilty and deserve to die. It'll be because they were correct in assuming that no one would care enough to get involved." I want to read that again. "So again, if the state is successful in their efforts to murder me on November 16th this year, it won't be because I'm actually guilty and deserve to die. It will be because they were correct in assuming that no one would care enough to get involved." In a recent study on the podcast, The Hidden Brain, which I find very informative, a psychologist shared that the more people who witness a devastating event, the fewer are likely to respond because they all think somebody else will do it. And I would add that to my own thoughts sometimes that are, well, should I really? Is this something I should do? You know, I question my own thoughts. So as not to be one of those, I wrote a check and I wrote a letter when I finished reading the book. And if any of you are interested in doing that, Keith Lamar has a website. There's information there about a petition, and I think writing letters is more powerful than petitions. And sending a check to help him with whatever process one has to do to get away from the death penalty. Maybe writing to the governor who would be the one who could turn it off. As I was writing this sermon, I was acutely aware of people's needs for home in so many ways. In my own world, Marion, and what she's been through and what we've been through trying to find a suitable place for her. Her own family abandoned her years ago when she transgendered. They live in Brazil now, and the only thing that they've been interested in is how much money they'll get when she dies, which just made me want to go and be non-peaceful. My brand new kitty, Sophia, whom I got a week ago today, who was given up by her home at the age of 9 because there were 2 other cats, 2 dogs, and a couple of children, and it was too chaotic, and she just ran and hid all the time. She finally, on day 5, came out from hiding. And if any of you want to see the pictures of her cuddling on my lap, she actually slept with me a little bit the night before and last night. So there's so many animals, and the animals in the Ukraine that are dying and abandoned. And but the increasing number of my friends who I find are searching for home because they've lost a husband or a young sister, or times are hard financially and they don't know how they're going to make it in retirement. There's so many people on the streets of Bellingham. Oh my God, I can't believe how many homeless people. I never saw a homeless person before I went to Ghana. None of us can heal the whole world. None of us can heal the whole one of any one of those problems, but things come to us. Katya came to me. I mean, she just came into my life, and I didn't say bye-bye. And I read this book, and I was moved by it. And I didn't say, oh, that was interesting, and throw it away. Things come into each one of our lives, and I think they come for a reason. And it's not necessarily for us to save them. It's for us to save ourselves. It's in being the wholeness of humanity, in responding and knowing that, as we say, what happens to someone happens to all of us. We must respond to these things. Yes, we have our comforts. Yes, we can have our entertainments. But I had a friend once who was a minister in a church, and somebody left $5,000. This was about 40 years ago, so that would be like, I don't know, $10,000 today. And people wanted to put in some frivolous things in the church that were not necessary. And Norm said to them, you can do that if you give 10% of that money to some social cause. And so the church began to do that whenever they had extra money and wondered what to do with it. They gave 10% to, and in this case, it was a home for Indigenous women. It's too easy to get into the flow of our normal lives and our patterns with our radio programs, our TV programs, our lunches on whenever, church on Sunday. We've got to act. We've got to live our values. There are so many opportunities, I'm sure, for action in this community. And I'm thinking, what needs are there that you as a group could address? Some of you are leaders. Some of you are followers. Some of you are adults, some children. Some visionaries, some doers. And who would be the spark plug to get that all started? I hope there's a spark plug here who feels moved to do so. I remember when we sang in church a wonderful hymn called Here I Am, Lord. This was in the Methodist church. And my husband's aunt was dying of cancer, and I was debating whether I would go and be with her to do hospice care for her. When we sang that hymn, it just really touched my heart. And so for the next 3 months, I did hospice care for her. Listen to your inner voice. and respond. That's all I have to say today.